Organizers are celebrating in Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock won his race against Republican Kelly Loeffler. Democrat John Ossoff is leading his race against Republican David Perdue. If Ossoff wins, the Democrats will have 50 seats in the Senate, giving Kamala Harris the tie-breaking votes. We'll go to Atlanta to get the latest. Later in the show, as Congress prepares to certify the Electoral College vote count, dozens of Republicans are planning to challenge Joe Biden's victory, repeating dangerous conspiracy theories. What precedent is this setting? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, it was a huge night in Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock won his race against Republican Kelly Loeffler. Democrat John Ossoff is leading his race against Republican David Perdue. He has already claimed victory. Once this is official, Democrats will have 50 seats in the Senate, giving Kamala Harris tie-breaking votes. This was a monumental win for Democrats and a monumental win for organizers. Joining us to talk about the incredible ground game that we've been talking about for a couple of months is Anoa Chonga. Anoa was on yesterday, and we're glad she's back today. Anoa is an organizer and a freelance journalist covering electoral justice, and she joins us from Atlanta. Hi, Anoa. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, what is the mood like on the ground in Georgia? What are you hearing from organizers?
A collective sigh of relief that we are almost done once this second race is called for this very long election cycle on top of the pandemic and everything else has been going on. But what I think a lot of people are happy about is seeing all of their work really bear fruit over not just the November win, but now in this runoff election where we saw record turnout. We haven't seen turnout like this in a runoff cycle in recent years. And so seeing so many voters turn back out for these three races was really phenomenal to watch unfold.
And a lot of people voted in this race who did not vote in the presidential race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a change in Georgia law, I think, after the 2018 election, if I'm remembering correctly, that previously to be able to vote in the runoff, you had to also vote in a general election, and that was challenged. So there was a major effort right after Election Day to register new voters. So voters who were either going to be 18 in time for this election or voters who had not actually voted before or had been engaged to get them registered, engaged, and voting. And I think that really made a huge difference, especially when we're looking at the turnout with younger folks participating in this process as well, and really getting people involved and excited about the prospect and possibility of not just flipping one Senate seat, but flipping two Senate seats really, I think, resonated with folks.
Let's talk about the ground game. I was looking at so many photos on Twitter last night of organizers that were just so happy about the work that they've done. It was a multiracial collective ground game really across the state. Unite Here tweeted, oh, we're talking about DeKalb. Is it DeKalb County?
DeKalb.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And they wrote, did you know African immigrant communities in DeKalb have grown to become a voting bloc that could tip the balance of a tight runoff? Unite Here led the only team of African immigrant canvassers to talk to thousands of these voters. I mean, that's just one of so many amazing stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think people really recognize and understand the multiracial, multi-ethnic, greatly diverse effort that has happened here on the ground. I had a conversation with a friend, Bianca Keaton, from Gwinnett County, and she was just saying, like, that diversity is a huge strength, but it's also a lot of big responsibility because we need to make sure that we're actually being responsive and engaging with all aspects of community and not just expecting people to show up and vote for a particular candidate. And really, organizers really leaned leaned into that, making sure that communities not only felt seen in representation in terms of leadership and just efforts that were happening, but also felt heard in terms of their issues and their concerns, or were trusted themselves to actually lead and do their own outreach. So whether it's this effort you're talking about with Unite Here in DeKalb County, or you're talking about, you know, folks in more rural areas in the state, we also saw, you know, really great turnout and engagement from organizations like GLAR and Mahinte. I believe Mahinte, just like 2 days before the election, had made it through the call list and had contacted every eligible Latino voter in the state. And so we saw these amazing efforts, often in language or culturally, you know, relevant to individual groups, that were engaging people on issues and concerns that were relevant to them and bringing them into the process, and not just how do we line up these voting blocks and check them off to be able to win for these candidates. And so this was really a collective and collaborative effort. The other thing I will say is, and I'm not like a Democrat or party person per se, I vote Dem in my personal capacity, but I'm not a party spokesperson or anything like that. But we have seen an investment, particularly when the Stacey Abrams campaign in 2018, with that coordinated campaign race in the general election, and how the Democrats shifted the way in which they engage with local communities. And so we had this amazing grassroots effort, but we also have a party, at least in part, they're not without their own criticisms, but at least in part, that's understanding more about how to engage and support people around the state and not just in the Metro Atlanta area.
Exactly. And to really focus on people who might not vote because they're mostly ignored. Mm-hmm. And this is really across the country. You brought up Mahinte, and Anna Barr tweeted that Mahinte contacted every Latino voter in Georgia in just 8 weeks, 310,000 doors, 257,000 calls. This is the biggest Latino voter turnout operation in Georgia's history. It happened in 2 months. I also want to give a shout out to Four Directions Native Vote, because the Native vote is really not getting that much attention. And they tweeted, "We've knocked on more than 14,200 doors, most of them more than once. Of the more than 3,600 people our organizers have connected with in person, we've secured vote pledges from 91% of them."
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing right now is really amazing. It's just learning more, because there's so many efforts, and a lot of it is not necessarily, we often see like or the organization just parachuting in and doing something and not engaging with folks locally. And there are so many different groups that have contributed to what happened in Georgia. And it wasn't just something that just happened in this election cycle or just happened in this runoff. This has been growing. And these are relationships and contacts that people have been making over the last several years. And so seeing that really bear fruit, and I appreciate you pointing out some of the other efforts as well, has really been, I think, also instructive for folks going forward. Because if we, you know, talk to our folks, if we speak on the issues that matter, and we get behind candidates that are worth supporting, we can really see, you know, shifts happen in a meaningful way. And I know they haven't actually got into the U.S. Senate yet, but when they get there, if there are issues or challenges, we're also, you know, people here are also ready and willing to hold their elected officials accountable. And that's what we can't be afraid or shy away from, the accountability piece, because accountability, I think, is as much about making sure people are staying true to what they say, but also showing up and letting people know that they're not alone, because it's not always easy to make the stance or go for particular issues, particularly with, you know, there's a long wish list of things folks are hoping to finally move out of the Senate. But we do know that this is a collective win of a lot of different people and a lot of different groups across this state. And it's a really, I think, powerful moment for folks to just reflect and just embrace and bask in the joy of the time.
Exactly. I mean, it really is a victory on many levels, a victory for people who believe that one man, Mitch McConnell, should not have the power to hold the people hostage for his corporate donors, which is exactly what he did on the relief bill. I mean, he had the power to stop judicial nominees, to stop appointees of Biden. He just had so much power. This is one man. So this is obviously a nationwide issue here, but I do want to focus on Georgians because I think that's also in some ways getting lost in this conversation because so much was at stake and really still is at stake. We talked about this a bit yesterday, Anoa, but these candidates, I mean, they couldn't be further apart. You had Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who wanted to get rid of health care for people who are barely hanging on. They were not fighting for relief. They're anti-choice. I mean, the list just goes on. Can you tell us, you know, what the issues around these issues that Warnock and Ossoff actually embrace? Because it just didn't get enough attention in the last few months.
Yeah, I mean, we saw so much of the vitriol. We've seen so much. I mean, so much of what happened in this race was overshadowed because of the vitriol and the temper tantrum that has been happening with the outgoing president and Republicans nationally around the veracity and the legalities around this election, whether it's here in the state of Georgia or nationally as a whole. But when we're looking really at some of these issues, I mean, there were also the issues with both Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in terms of the information they received around COVID-19 and the different financial steps that they took earlier on before we all knew about how wide scale this pandemic was actually going to be. And so there were a lot of concerns, but I think when you're talking about a state like Georgia that has not expanded Medicaid, that has had at least nine rural hospital closures in the last several years, you have a huge backlog in terms of unemployment benefits applications being processed. So you have people struggling, you know, with the ongoing pandemic. And we're also the state that quote unquote opened first, right? And when things were shut down, we barely shut down in the spring and our governor rushed to open. So we've also been struggling with, you know, the impacts of the pandemic in multiple different ways. So people are tired and really want to see, you know, their needs get met and they want to feel heard. Unfortunately, you know, looking at some of the votes taken with David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, I mean, David Perdue as a senator supported gutting the or repealing the ACA multiple times. And while the ACA has its own issues, repealing without an actual viable replacement that would make sure that people have access to health care, that people can afford that health care, that people with pre-existing conditions would actually, you know, be able to get health care, because that's another major concern. There's so many. And then, you know, Kelly Loeffler, similarly with the health care plan she put out, was a hodgepodge of nothingness that would protect people. So I think at the end of the day, people were very motivated about making sure that we start to see our needs being met and having at least the ability to have a conversation with elected officials who at least listen to those concerns instead of glossing over them.
Right. Today, we are talking about what happened in Georgia last night. We're still waiting for the rest of the votes to come in, but John Ossoff has declared victory. We're speaking with Anoa Chonga, an organizer and freelance journalist covering electoral justice. If you have any questions or comments about this massive, massive win in Georgia, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have a couple of emails from listeners who just say thank you, thank you, thank you to all of the organizers on the ground in Georgia. You know, Anoa, I think it also speaks to the fact that the Democrats often just write off certain states, thinking that they're a quote red state. And, you know, I remember some Dems years and years ago said that we needed to have a 50-state strategy. But the criticism is that you still have these high-paid consultants who rely more on technology than old-fashioned door knocking. And at the end of the day, old-fashioned door knocking really does make a massive, massive difference.
Mm-hmm. I'm old-fashioned door knocking, which folks had to modify how they do that and how they engage in having these conversations because of the pandemic. But we did see people mass up, socially distance, washing hands, you know, all that. I mean, so many of the organizations that did this work, the New Georgia Project, Black Voters Matter, Working Families, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Mahinte, so many organizations made sure that their staff had PPE, made sure that folks understood how to approach people at doors. A lot of times people were really just doing what we call a lit drop. So dropping off literature versus versus actually talking and engaging with people. But that was really important. But you're right, though. We do see that this traditional effort, this mentality that, oh, you know, that place is a certain way, so you don't, you know, waste your time. But that's because that's a completely different value system at work. And what we do know, even when we hear people talking about how they need to figure out how to win over people who voted for Donald Trump, and this is not advocating for ignoring people's needs or conditions, but at the same time, we had several million more people not vote at all for either presidential candidate, major presidential candidate. We had about 80 million people not vote in this general election. And those are people who are not spoken to oftentimes in attempts to people who try to win over moderate Republicans instead of investing in folks who feel like the system does not benefit them. And part of it is because we do have Democrats who will come to our communities and say, yes, vote for us because we're better than the other people. But then you see commercials, you see comments, you see interviews with them chasing behind Republican voters. And so that causes confliction. That makes people believe that you're not sincere. And so they don't want to be a part of the process. So what we see here in Georgia, we saw a lot of self-determination on behalf of organizers and really a commitment to make sure that Georgia, this win, this election cycle was going to be dictated to the best extent possible by Georgians. Being able to overcome the high price, usually white coastal consultants, that is going to be a part of, I think, the longer term political struggle that folks have. But I think we do see now, you know, at least being able on a large scale to make the case for why people need to direct invest directly in communities and trust local organizers to do the work that they know will bear fruit in their own communities. I mean, you know your community better than I do, and I know my community better than someone else, and so on. So it would be ridiculous for me to think that I can go into a, you know, Korean community or an Indian American community or, you know, a rural Black Southern community that I've never been to before and think that I can tell them how they need to talk to their people when these are people who have been a part of their lives and they've been in communicating with their, you know, for years. So that is what we need to, you know, people call it relational organizing or whatever other terms, distributed organizing. I mean, talking to our folks, connecting with our people, what we ordinarily do is how we are able to build and win. And also recognizing that it's not going to just be some magical one done instance. It takes time and investment. And we have to get used to that long range planning when we're talking about running elections and winning.
It's such a great point. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. Good morning to your guest. You know, I feel like if someone knows what it feels like to be short of breath most of the time, and then you have a weight taken off your chest, and you say, "Boy, I've been short of breath all the time," and that's kind of what I feel like. I mean, a lot of people I know, you know, have had very little energy, and it's been this constant barrage of politics that are so anti-human. And so anti-democratic. And, you know, I just wanted to thank your guest and for all the people in Georgia and all the people over the country who just busted their butts to make this very, relatively speaking, very narrow win possible. And gee, as Katie Porter said, say it with me, Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Bill. I mean, what are your thoughts about this, Noah? I mean, as someone who covers these issues, again, going back to the fact that one man has the power to just stop such important legislation, like, you know, $1,200, but people can't afford to feed their families. It's been months since people have had a decent relief. I mean, Bill makes a great point.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say thank you, Bill, for shouting out Representative Katie Porter, who's one of my favorite people. Got to meet her back in her primary in 2018. But yeah, I mean, the way the Senate is even set up and I mean, you know, there are people who call for the abolition, you know, abolishing the Senate, but it is like having Mitch McConnell, you know, stand and object to so much progress. We have the Voting Rights Advancement Act that has been sitting for, I think, approximately a year now, which would be the replacement fix for the gutted VRA. We have, you know, the Heroes Act was passed by the House last May, and we only saw that piecemeal of COVID relief just before New Year's. So it is, or it was signed just before New Year's, and just recently people are just now starting to get it. So we have a real problem in the system. But one of the things that was happening here in Georgia with these commercials, like in the final stretch. So on the one hand, you have Republicans making these really wild conspiratorial claims and outlandish, you know, claims about, you know, what's happening in government. But then on the other hand, you had them running these really racist commercials. There were a couple different ones with all, there were only white people in the commercials talking about needing balance. There was one in particular, it was a white woman wearing all white in an all white kitchen. And she was talking about how she voted for Joe Biden, but she was voting for David and Kelly because we needed balance in this country. And this notion that somehow this is reasonable, that we have balance, that you need to have a mixture to have balance, when we're clearly seeing the obstructionist leadership from Mitch McConnell. Even when Republicans in his own party were saying, yes, we support the $2,000 that people were talking about a week or so ago. Even then, even members of his own party were saying, like, call the vote. And he was like, no, I'm not going to do it. So having that one person stand in the way of so much opportunity and possibility for the entire country, I can only imagine how people in other states are feeling right now, knowing the outcome of these two Senate races that we've had.
Exactly. And Bill, to your point about how close this was, I just crunched some numbers. On the Warnock side, you had over 4.4 million people voting, and Warnock is ahead with 98% in by just over, well, almost 55,000 votes. And then John Ossoff with 98% in, he's winning by over 35,000. What's incredible about this, Anoa, is they're winning by a larger margin than Joe Biden. He won by 11,799 votes.
I mean, I think that's definitely a testament to a couple of different things. You know, some will say that the outgoing president has suppressed their own vote. And I think the Secretary of State and others did warn him of that. But we also see that the amazing turnout that happened. So the fact that we have Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff winning by larger margins in the runoff election. We know that there's a significant drop off between a general election and a runoff election, but that's the work that organizations put in the last 2 months, really being able to make sure that either new voters who were eligible were able to vote, or that folks who did vote in the general would also return and come back as well. And we're seeing that folks in several different counties, whether they've been rural counties with large Black populations or, you know, urban, suburban areas, that people showed up in significant percentages, almost similar to their election day total. So it's been, like I said before, it's been pretty phenomenal to watch. And not even from a partisan standpoint, but just thinking about just what it is to have people running that type of campaign and effort, an additional 2 months on top of this very long election cycle is very impressive.
You're right. You know, the other thing is, when we think about the legislation that will come up in the Senate now, it didn't get much attention, but the House has passed some really good legislation on transparency, money in politics, voting rights. And Mitch McConnell just would not allow this legislation to come up for a vote. And I just want to ask you before we end, we talked about this yesterday, that there's been so much voter suppression in Georgia, especially, you know, Republicans wanting to make it as hard as possible for voters of color to go to the polls. 198,000 Georgia residents were illegally purged from voter rolls. This is according to the ACLU, based on reporting from Greg Pallast. And The Appeal had a piece about voter suppression. And they wrote, by winning a narrow majority in the upper chamber, Democrats could at last stop the Republican assault on voting rights if its centrist members have the courage to do so. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like I said earlier, like you just mentioned, the VRAA is the replacement for the Voting Rights Act, and it doesn't just simply replace the Voting Rights Act. There are so many other components that help address some of the issues that we've noted that have happening across the country since Shelby v. Holder in 2013. And so as we're seeing coming out of this election cycle, that absolutely passage of the VRAA needs to be a priority among several other pieces of legislation. I mean, we just saw the House a couple of weeks ago pass the historic Moore Act, which would decriminalize marijuana at the federal level, including getting rid of federal prosecutions for marijuana possession. So that would open up a real conversation about marijuana legalization and decriminalization at the state level. So we need to understand this moment also as being a mandate. There was a lot of, you know, mealy mouth, I think, conversations right after the general election about what really won. But what we're seeing here in Georgia is that you can run very strong and bold on issues that are directly impacting, you know, communities of color and other folks, and still win and not have to worry about throwing people under the bus to appease the other side. So right. I think there's a real lesson there.
A real lesson there. And before we let you go, I also want to give a shout out to the youth, because mm-hmm. a lot of people like to say that the youth don't vote. But in this case, they did. There were a couple pieces in NBC. Gen Z is using TikTok to encourage youth voter turnout. And then the Washington Post had a piece, youth voter turnout in Georgia runoff shows signs of sustained enthusiasm post November.
Yeah, I have a 19-year-old at home who voted. This was her first election cycle, and I'll be able to vote with both my children in 2022. But that energy is definitely there because people are talking to them like they have a say and like they're actual real people with, you know, experiences mm-hmm. instead of just talking at them. So it is really encouraging to see younger folks coming in and not just turning out to vote, but also leading campaigns, also taking part in leadership roles in some of the organizing that is happening and speaking up and setting agendas. So I think also allowing people the space to set do their own agenda setting and tell us what they need and what their interests are goes a long way.
Well, we've got a lot more emails just thanking organizers. So thank you, Anoa, for all of your great work, and thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Anoa Changa is an organizer and freelance journalist covering electoral justice. You can find her work at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, as Congress prepares to certify the Electoral College vote, which is happening right now, dozens of Republicans in the House and Senate are planning to challenge Biden's victory. We will talk about the precedent this is setting. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about what a Democratic-controlled House and Senate will mean for Joe Biden's agenda. People could finally receive $2,000 stimulus checks, which McConnell blocked for months. More than 25 million workers are still unemployed, and over 1 million people are actually still waiting for aid that they applied for back in March. So what should Biden's priorities be now that we are almost certain to have a 50-50 Senate? That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Well, about 30 minutes ago, Congress gathered to officially certify each state's electoral college votes. And according to NBC, it looks like Representative Paul Gosar, a Republican from Arizona, along with 60 of his Republican colleagues, quickly objected to the votes that were awarded to Biden by the state of Arizona. He was joined by at least Republican Senator Ted Cruz, who stood and was applauded in signing their first objection to the Arizona electors. The joint session then retired. This means that there will now be up to 2 hours of debate in the House and the Senate. So we're talking about what this means because a number of attorneys and citizen activists say that this actually sets a very dangerous precedent. What might happen in the future if extreme Republicans control the House and the Senate? And what about their supporters who believe these conspiracy theories? There were fights in D.C. with a number of far-right groups joining. Trump spoke to them this morning. And we are talking about all of this with Sylvia Albert, director of the Voting and Elections Program for Common Cause. This is an organization that works to build a democracy for all. Sylvia works with the national staff and Common Cause state offices to press for reforms that expand access to the ballot. Hi, Sylvia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what are your overall thoughts about all of this, that Trump is still refusing to concede, and now we know that Republicans in the House and Senate are challenging the results? How dangerous is all of this?
Oh, well, I think you have to remember there are two different tracks here. There is the reality of how will this affect this election? And the answer to that is that it won't. Joe Biden was elected president. He will be inaugurated on January 20th. This does nothing to affect that. What it does do is lessen people's faith in democracy. When you have such a large portion of the population being lied to by the president and various members of his party, they have now adopted this rhetoric and don't have faith in our elections. And really, you know, the strength of a democracy is that there are free and fair elections, and when somebody loses, they go away. So I think this is really dangerous for the future.
Well, I'm reading from Reuters right now. This morning, Trump told cheering supporters he would never concede the election. He said, quote, "We will never give up. We will never concede." He claimed again, without any evidence, that hundreds of thousands of people who were attending the vote, the event, that they were going to stop the steal. I mean, he just keeps repeating these conspiracy theories. And, you know, a number of people who've been quoted in articles about what this means say that this is just really dangerous, especially if you have a future House and Senate with people like Ted Cruz in power.
Absolutely. And I think what's so important to note this time around is that there were over 60 lawsuits around the country, and not a single one found any evidence of anything. And these were by these were judges appointed by Democrats, by Republicans, by President Trump himself. And this was also an election that, for all the talk of it being close, it actually wasn't that close, right? President-elect Biden won by more than President Trump did 4 years ago. So when you think about that, that we can have this much distraction and this much danger when there actually is no evidence of anything, right? Imagine, if you will, if we were in 2000 and we were down to Florida and 537 ballots, and we had this sort of rhetoric coming from the president and this sort of action, that's much scarier. Right. But because, you know, because we don't have that right now, we are able to survive. But it's definitely denting our democracy.
Well, and I guess the thing that's and this is what I think about a lot. The fact that so many people believe these lies and so many people get their information from the OAN network or these far right YouTube channels. You know, what do we do about this? I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot because from the election to COVID, this morning, Democracy Now! Played a clip from a guy who was at this, quote, "Stop the Steal" protest, Clay Clark. And he said last night, 150 of us went into Whole Foods and we dressed up like people that aren't idiots hiding from a virus that's not deadly. We did not wear a mask. Who here is up to the task of not wearing a mask? And then he just said, go hug someone. I mean, this is just really dangerous that people are believing what's coming out of, you know, Trump's mouth, the far right. I don't want to call it media because it's not, but it's OAN, these YouTube channels. I mean, they're just living in a different world. And I don't think people yet have really talked about how we should deal with this moving forward. I mean, people have theories about how to do it, but I don't think there's one sort of silver bullet about how we deal with this.
I agree. I don't think there's a silver bullet. And I think what's key to recognize is that this is not just in kind of the political sphere. There is this rejection of data and science and intelligence that's happening. It's happening, and we've been seeing it in, you know, climate change issues for many years. But this is not just a political issue. This really is kind of a dumbing down of America, in a sense, of not reflecting science and facts. Instead, saying, you know, your opinion is as valid as anybody else's, regardless of the lack of strength in your opinion. And that's, I don't know how to fix that, but I think that's, you know, a sociological issue, much larger even than politics.
Well, and I guess what's also scary at the end of the day is Trump is going to leave on January 20th. That is going to happen, as you said. I mean, it's crazy that we even have to repeat that. But you have Republicans like Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley. I've got the numbers here. According to Politico, as of yesterday, 13 Republican senators are planning to reject Joe Biden's victory. They also include Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. Kelly Loeffler, who just lost her race in Georgia, is going to challenge this. So these Republicans, well, Kelly Loeffler is not going to be there anymore, but Ted Cruz will be, Josh Hawley will be, Marsha Blackburn will be. And then on the House side, according to reports, over 100 House Republicans are going to reject Biden's victory.
Yeah, you know, I think what this really shows is the ugly side of politics. You know, for the most part, I don't believe that these members actually believe what they are saying. Mm-hmm. Many of them are lawyers. They have all read the court transcripts. They have all looked at the actual lack of evidence. But what we're seeing is the political power that the president has over his base. And the power that the president has over his base, from the surveys and information I've seen, is not shared by the Republican Party. So to say that an individual is loyal to the president, they are not loyal to the Republican Party. So these politicians want to hold on to that loyalty. They want to hold on to the president's endorsements. They want to hold on to the president's money, or the money that he can bring in. And so this is really how they say, like, you don't want to see how the sausage is made. This is seeing how the sausage is made. This is the ugly part of politics, the ugly part of governance, which is doing what's best for me, regardless of the harm to anybody else.
Today, we're speaking with Sylvia Albert, director of the Voting and Elections Program for Common Cause, an organization that works to build a democracy for all. And if you would like to join us, we're just getting real-time information. I'm looking at the NBC live blog. You've got Republicans who stood up this morning just about 30 minutes ago, and they are rejecting Biden's win, which means that they have to debate in the House and the Senate. So what are your thoughts on this? What precedent does this set? How dangerous is this that you're going to have, according to reports, more than 100 Republicans rejecting Biden's victory? And in many backhanded ways, Trump is supporting and inciting the violence that we are seeing on the streets. NBC just posted that police evacuate an area near the Capitol as pro-Trump protesters storm the barricades. The U.S. Capitol Police said they were evacuating areas near the Capitol as pro-Trump protesters attempted to storm barricades set up outside the perimeter of the complex. The Library of Congress, located directly across the street from the Capitol, was evacuated, and people were told to remain calm and move in a safe manner to the exits. So what are your thoughts about what this means for the future? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. What are your thoughts also about the violence, Sylvia? When I was reading that from NBC News, I was thinking about what happened to Gretchen Whitmer, the governor from Michigan, who was the target of an alleged kidnapping plot that included dangerous threats of violence.
Well, in terms of the future, you know, what I am concerned about, and I think what a lot of your listeners should be concerned about, is the effect on voting rights going forward. We are already seeing that Republicans in states are trying to use this rhetoric and these lies as reasons to suppress the vote. So in states like Pennsylvania, there's talk about revoking no excuse absentee mail, or, you know, other things like that. And so that is a concern to me, the concern that this could have an effect on future elections by taking away people's rights to vote. That is why we are, you know, Common Cause and others are in favor of HR 1 and other federal legislation that would protect voters' rights in the states. It's a legislation that provides for automatic voter registration and early vote and all these things that we saw this year were great and led to record turnout. But unfortunately, because that turnout was people that didn't vote for the Republican Party, the Republican Party is looking to pull back. So I really encourage people to be paying attention at the state level to state legislation that is going to be going forward.
Right, because the Democrats fail to flip state legislatures, which does give these Republican politicians an opening to pass even more voter suppression, specifically targeting communities of color. What are you hearing, if anything, on Capitol Hill about H.R. 1? I mean, once if John Ossoff is officially confirmed to be the winner in Georgia, the Dems will be able to bring HR, their version of the Voting Rights Act, to the Senate. What are you hearing on Capitol Hill about that? Anything?
Well, you know, I have heard that Speaker Pelosi has affirmed her dedication to bringing HR 1 and HR 4, which is the voting rights, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, to the floor. But, you know, I think we have to remember that the Democratic Party is not a single block. Just because one has 50 votes in the Senate does not in any way mean that all of the really great legislation that was passed by the Democratic House in the last 2 years is actually going to be able to pass this, you know, a Senate with 50 Democrats. So we absolutely, you know, support that legislation. But I think being realistic about how we get there and that there will have to be compromises.
Because you have people like Joe Manchin, who is a conservative Dem, and then Kristen Sinema. What are the numbers when you crunch them? I mean, I know it's a simplistic question, but how many conservative Dems might get in the way of passing, you know, solid progressive legislation?
Oh, I am not our Hill lobbyist, so I don't know the answer to that question, but I think, you know, especially with the filibuster still in existence, the realities of the situation are that this is, you know, as much as the right likes to scream socialism and everything, this is not an issue where this is not a day where all of a sudden AOC rules the land and all, you know, quote unquote left wing progressive policies are going to pass. It's right. Congress doesn't move very quickly.
But the Democrats have to know. I mean, they have to deliver for the people or they could easily lose the House in 2022 and possibly lose the White House in 2024. I mean, people need to see tangible changes.
I agree with you. You know, we are for legislation that, you know, supports the people, that actually helps the people, that protects their rights. And, you know, we actively push for that. I'm just, you know, being a little bit, trying to be a little bit more realistic so that, you know, my hopes aren't dashed when things don't go as easily as I would like to.
Right. Oh, we have an email from Anthony who says, delighted at the huge success in Georgia, but it is so important that the Democrats stop gloating and come up with some progressive ideas that can be supported by all. This will be a very hard task, but unless they succeed, they will not have control for long. And, you know, when you look at the polling and you take the wording out of it, people are in favor of gun control, a higher minimum wage, in taxing the ultra wealthy and the wealthy, taking money out of politics. I mean, when you take the wording out of it, Sylvia, I mean, the people really do want change on so many levels.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. You know, it's always been baffling that the support for gun control in this country has been above 70%, but we can't even get a hearing on the floor. And that has been because Mitch McConnell has, you know, stopped it from happening. We would like to see that sort of, progressive legislation come to the floor. And I agree with your caller that something has to happen. The people are demanding change.
Right. Well, if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? We're joined by Sylvia Albert, Director of the Voting and Elections Program for Common Cause, an organization that works to build a democracy for all. What precedent is being set with these Republicans challenging Biden's victory? What are your thoughts on this? And I'm just looking at updates from NBC about people who are gathering in Washington, D.C., Trump supporters. It looks like a pretty big crowd there. And also, we should mention, let me just grab this note because I want to get the details right. Yesterday, on Monday, actually, Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio was arrested in D.C. on a warrant charging him with burning a Black Lives Matter banner taken from a Methodist church in December. He faces a misdemeanor charge of destruction of property and two felony counts of possessing extended gun magazines at the time of his arrest. This is according to The Washington Post. And again, I know this isn't your area of expertise, Sylvia, but just the violence that we're seeing, you know, I'm thinking also about the number of public health workers who have left their jobs in small towns because they got so many threats. I mean, I'm sure, you know, this is for another show. In fairness, I don't want to put you on the spot on this, but we're not out of this when Trump leaves. And that's what's so concerning.
Absolutely. You know, we also saw, you know, we saw this huge influx of people volunteering to be poll workers to really step up in hard times. And then we saw them attacked and doxxed and threatened. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if none of those people ever wanted to be poll workers again.
Right.
Trumpism and does not die, you know, when Trump walks out of the office, as, you know, his sons have been quite vocal about he owns the Republican Party. He is the leader of the Republican Party. So this, you know, I honestly don't know the answer to how we deal with this. I am in Washington, D.C. I have received no less than 10 emails from family in California saying, please don't leave your house. Hmm. You know, it is frightening. And it's what is most frightening, you know, we as a society, you know, have rules and laws that we stick to. And there has always been a segment of society that who decides that they are not going to follow the rules that they object to. But there has never been somebody with the power of the presidency saying to them, yes, continue to do so. Yes, you know, spread violence. And, you know, I'm hoping that when the president leaves office, you know, his megaphone will slightly get smaller, but I don't expect that that's going to really, really do much, honestly.
We have an email from Roseanne who says, don't forget the Supreme Court. I think we need to be a little more clear-eyed about the chances of actually enacting, not just passing, progressive legislation. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't try and in all ways possible to do so, but make sure the efforts and results are sufficiently transparent that people realize where the roadblocks lie. Great point, Roseanne. What about that? Because Roseanne is right. The conservatives have a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court.
You know, I think that there is, I agree with her. There are kind of different avenues to take when trying to enact progressive policies. And some of them mean taking smaller bites of the apple and being very deliberate in actions. So that might mean not going as far as some people would like in order to, you know, ensure that things don't get hung up in litigation. You know, the one thing is, you know, the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution, but often what we have seen from the Supreme Court is interpretation of things that weren't specifically in law. So if you can get progressive legislation passed, that is much more likely, you know, to be able to withstand legal challenges as opposed to arguing progressive interpretation of kind of generic precedent. Hmm.
It is amazing when you think about how the system works, because Republicans can pass a massive, massive tax cut for the wealthy and corporations, but we have to take baby steps just to get basic health care rights.
Yeah, I have often wondered, and, you know, I have a poli sci degree from UC Berkeley, but also could not tell, but still have no idea why, you know, the kind of the left is often fractured and the right acts, you know, as one block and uses their power that way. It's the nature of the work that we do.
Well, we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Tara in Oakland. Hi, Tara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. So I think there's an underlying theme going across all of the issues that we're facing today, racial inequity, environment, science, voting, people's beliefs. I think it all comes down to what people believe and why they believe and what their sources are that they're using. And I think education could be a phenomenal, a very strong source of changing all of that. If we had every child in this country, K through 8, that had a teacher who was African American, kindergarten teacher, African American, first grade teacher, Latina, second grade teacher, a gay or lesbian person, and if each child had, and these would have to be phenomenal teachers, but if each child had a person of difference who has, you know, religious differences from themselves, I think that would change our society as a whole for the better. I think we would have greater understanding. I think a lot of our issues are related to lack of understanding of others. And the second would be also to include in that education the obviously how to choose your sources. You know, I mean, any good teacher would be teaching their children how to recognize what a good and reliable source is to believe and which are not.
Well, Tara, I love what you just said, and we'll definitely do shows around your ideas. I think it's just so important. A final thoughts, Sylvia, on Tara's comment?
You know, I think education is key. I think we can also add to that kind of civic education. Mm-hmm. Right? Understanding the way the system works and why it works that way. We saw, you know, massive confidence, lack of confidence in the election. But what we did see also is when we actually explained every single step to people, when we showed them what absentee balloting looks like, what tabulation looks like, they understood it. And, you know, as Tara said, you know, people are fearful of things they don't understand because they aren't exposed to them. Right. So more exposure and more education, absolutely, I agree. But I think it will be harder to ensure that every student has access to teachers of different faiths and colors and genders. But what we might be able to get, you know, more easily is ensuring that civic education really is drummed into students at a young age and begins to thrive.
Yes, we will definitely do a show about what it will take to bring civics back. Sylvia Albert is director of the Voting and Elections Program for Common Cause, an incredible organization that works to build a democracy for all. Sylvia, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for that call, Tara. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running and engineering the show. You can find more information and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.